From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The latest underage drinking incident involving presidential daughter Jenna Bush has created understandable unease in the White House, some of which has played out in the briefing room. Houston Chronicle reporter Bennett Roth was chastised by the administration for asking a question Press Secretary Ari Fleischer deemed off-limits. The tempest began in a briefing following President Bush's discussion of parental roles in dealing with substance abuse. Ben Roth, what was the indelicate question?
Considering the president's, you know, urging this parental involvement, I said, has he talked to his own children about drugs and drinking? And then I said, and considering his daughter was recently cited for underage drinking, isn't that a sign that sometimes parents can't have the influence that they may hope to have? Ari Fleischer then bristled, sort of dodged the question and said, well, I hope that, you know, the press doesn't go there and respects the privacy. And then that was the end of the press conference, and he left.
But it's what followed the press briefing that is particularly unsettling.
About maybe 2 hours later, I got a call from Ari Fleischer, and who immediately told me that he thought I was out of bounds in asking the question, that none of the other national press had gone there about the questioning of, you know, the lives of the daughters. And he said it had been, in quote, noted in the building that I had asked the question.
Nobody else went there. Is there anyone in the press corps who objects to asking questions about Jenna Bush's brushes with the law?
Well, there are some of my colleagues who I think are very uncomfortable with it, and I'm not totally comfortable with it myself. I mean, it's always, you always feel a little bit, you know, squeamish about this. And there are some colleagues who do really feel that we shouldn't be, you know, getting involved in these daughters. I mean, they didn't run for the office. And for the most part, I agree with that. However, you do have the issue that they were arrested. There was a citation, and that, I think that changes the issue.
You say that he told you it was your question had been noted in the White House. That's a not-so-veiled threat, isn't it?
I took it that way. And of everything he said, that was the thing that bothered me the most. I mean, that was a kind of a bullying tactic I thought was a little out of bounds on his part. I mean, he has a perfect right not to like the question and call me and talk to me about it, but to sort of say that, well, if you ask these kind of questions, we're you know, keeping lists or things like that.
And not to sick the IRS on you, but maybe to freeze you out of reporting opportunities or something like that?
Well, I mean, that was the kind of funny thing and kind of liberating thing about it. I mean, this administration has not been very open or easy to get information from to begin with. They're pretty parsimonious with the information they parcel out. So, you know, there's not much they can really do to you because they don't give you a whole lot.
How have your colleagues responded, and is there anybody who's coming to your defense in the White House press corps?
A lot of people were coming to my defense. I would say most people. And other people had had similar incidents happen to them. It just didn't happen to get leaked to the Washington Post, which I didn't do, but, I mean, it did get out, and I think other people felt that they had, you know, suffered similar kind of tongue lashings from Ari, and that they felt that, you know, this was a sign that maybe this was more of a pattern than they had thought. But it was mostly supportive. I mean, there's this feeling that we should be able to ask any question we want, and, you know, they don't have to answer it. But this idea that there are certain questions that are out of bounds, I think, strikes all of us as just not right.
Does the president have a nickname for you?
Not yet. I don't know if I'll get close enough to him these days for him to give me one.
Well, in that event, Slim, thank you for joining us.
Thanks.
Bennett Roth is the White House correspondent for the Houston Chronicle. Ari Fleischer, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Bennett Roth believes that you were trying to intimidate him. Were you?
Well, that's very odd. He never said anything like that to me when we talked. In fact, he told me he appreciated hearing from me. And he even acknowledged directly to me that next time he thought maybe he should ask the question in private rather than ask it at a briefing, owing to the family sensitivities of such a personal question.
What did you mean by noted in the White House?
Every reporter should understand a question like that will get noted inside the White House because people thought it was an inappropriate question, obviously so. And I called to let him know that. There's an interesting phenomenon in Washington. There's a tendency for reporters sometimes when they talk to press secretaries, they kind of tuck their tails in a little bit, but then when they talk to their journalistic colleagues, they puff out their chests. And I think, frankly, that's what's happened here.
Mr. Roth says that it seemed like a perfectly natural question considering the circumstances with Jenna, and the discussion that the president just was having on the very subject of parents and their kids discussing substance abuse. I'm stunned, frankly, that you or anyone else was shocked by the juxtaposition of the question and the press event.
The question really wasn't the president's speech on drug abuse. The context was, will you share with us what the president has said to his daughter? I think that on a matter like this, most people believe that the fact that there was an incident that involved the law is and should be reportable, and the White House has never raised any objections to that. Where the White House has objected and will continue to object is when reporters then seek to pin off of that to find out what a man who's the president of the United States says to his child in a father-daughter relationship.
Well, here's an alternative approach on this. What if a reporter asks a question that he or she deems relevant, and the politician or the spokesman for the politician simply declines to answer and accepts that the reporter was doing what he perceived to be his job and the spokesman doing what he perceived to be his, and no sense of betrayal or someone stepping out of line?
There are times when press secretaries should, and I will continue to do so, politely and directly tell reporters if I think they have asked something that they should think twice about. That's always been the practice in the White House between the White House press secretary and the press corps. I think what's important is that at all times be done professionally, and reporters appreciate that.
Ari Fleischer, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you. My pleasure.
Ari Fleischer is the press secretary for President George W. Bush.
This week marks the 20th anniversary of a report by federal scientists that noted the emergence of a disease we'd later know as AIDS. The anniversary has initiated a spasm of retrospection by the media, which has been assessing the impact of AIDS on the arts, behavior, activism, and research. On the Media's Amy Eddings attended a forum in which the audience put the media itself under the microscope.
Larry Kramer's message for the activists and journalists at Newsweek magazine's forum on two decades of AIDS was bleak.
What you have to do is you have to find a way to save the world. An apocalypse is about to happen or whatever. And that sounds hyperbolic, and it's true.
Kramer thinks saving the world from AIDS is the media's job. It's certainly been his. HIV positive since 1981, he founded the Gay Men's Health Crisis and ACT UP, and he writes prodigiously about the epidemic. He's featured in Newsweek, as is researcher Dr. Seth Berkley, who expressed frustration at the slow pace of research.
No vaccine has been fully tested anywhere in the world to see if it works against HIV. Now, to me, that's shocking. You just heard. This is the worst plague since the 13th century, and we're just getting around to testing some vaccines after many, many, many years of pushing them through development.
He says this is partly due to the breathtaking complexities of HIV and how it turns a person's own immune system against itself. But Dr. Berkley, Larry Kramer, and others in the room also believe the political will hasn't been generated to get the job done. Newsweek's editor Mark Whitaker says the media doesn't create that will by itself.
I mean, in our society, priorities are driven largely not by the media or even by the public sector, I mean, to some degree, but also, and we're doing our part, and I think you can't fault us for not paying attention to this crisis over the last 20 years. But by the private sector.
I can fault you for that. I mean, it's got to be paid attention to every day. You know, the plague doesn't go away for four issues. It gets worse.
Many at the forum agreed with activist Ann Northrup, who told the panel that even when the media does cover the crisis, it ignores the politics.
The United States at this very moment is doing everything it can to stop any advance on stopping this plague. It is suing Brazil. It is refusing to let money go to the purchase of generic versions of the drugs. And I can't tell you how angry it makes us that you keep doing these stupid stories about the medicine when it's all about the politics.
Then came the new drugs, which delay the onset of AIDS. Headlines spoke of breakthroughs and remarkable recoveries and new hope. Many feel those stories set back AIDS research and encourage the current rise in risky behavior among young gay men and others. Newsday's Lori Garrett believes many of her colleagues, hungry for something new to report, lack the proper skepticism about the drug cocktails. She also chides journalists for their short memory about AIDS developments. But unlike activist Larry Kramer, Garrett does not believe it is the media's job to save the world from the epidemic.
If you really felt that it was a state of emergency, it's not your role to be an advocate for a particular position, but to give that level of coverage. It's the quantity of the coverage and the depth at which you pursue the story that's really the issue.
For Dr. Robert Blendon, professor of health policy at Harvard School of Public Health, the media's coverage has influenced America's awareness of AIDS.
The media effect can be most shown when asked about what are the top health problems for the world. Essentially, AIDS ties with cancer. So the fact that so many Americans would identify AIDS as one of the top health problems of the world is strictly a media effect. They would have no experience. They'd have no way of knowing that.
A Kaiser Family Foundation survey found nearly all Americans know that HIV can be transmitted through unprotected sex and sharing intravenous needles. Through the media, AIDS has become a part of our culture, written about in Bruce Springsteen songs, dramatized in plays like Angels in America, movies like Philadelphia, and campaigned against with the help of red ribbons, charity bike rides, and walkathons. Two-thirds of Americans in the Kaiser survey said the government should do more. But Harvard's Dr. Blendon says translating this awareness into dollars, lots of dollars, will require both editorial opinion and political leadership to convince the public that this is a threat beyond all other threats. They would have to see AIDS not only as an epidemic, says Dr. Blendon, but as a war. For On the Media, I'm Amy Eddings.
Coming up, a Serbian journalist gets no honor for accepting an award, the working poor drop under the radar, and amateur sportscasters call games on the net.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio. We're back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone with a couple of your letters about last week's show. We talked about the FCC's decision to fine a Portland, Oregon community radio station for playing a song called Your Revolution. It's a rap song that describes in rough language one woman's refusal to be used for sex in the name of politics. Greg Bilbro of Austin, Texas, writes that radio stations can go on for months talking about oral sex, but we cannot have a woman reject, admittedly in strong language, the increasingly common assumption of young men that women are but sex toys to be used and thrown away. The government cannot penalize the messenger just because a few people don't like the message.
This from David Hurst in New York. Your piece on non-traditional casting reminded me of an experience I had more than 25 years ago when I was doing a semester abroad in Bonn, Germany. I was attending a production of Mozart's Don Carlos. The role of Philip, the King of Spain, was played by a Japanese baritone. As he stood atop a scaffold and sang an aria, it suddenly hit me. I was watching a Japanese man play a Spanish king singing in Italian on a German stage. Only in opera, I concluded.
More next week. Please keep them coming to onthemedia@wnyc.org, and please tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name.
The war in Serbia has been over for 2 years, the Slobodan Milosevic regime for 6 months. But the echoes in Serbian society still resound, in the media no less than any place else. One such reverberation involves B92, the independent radio and TV network that alone among Serbian broadcast media defied Milosevic to report on the systematic destruction from within of the Serbian nation. A hero of that journalistic struggle is Bojana Lekic, who risked death as B92's highest profile reporter and interviewer. Among those she exposed were the notorious Karic brothers, a family of war profiteers who grew fabulously wealthy working hand in glove with the Milosevic regime. But recently, the Karic family's connection to Bojana Lekic took a new turn in the form of a cash journalism prize, and she has left her job as a result. Joining me now to discuss the situation is Nebojša Samardžić, a lawyer representing the Association of Electronic Media in Belgrade.
It's nice to talk to you.
Let's talk about the Karic brothers for a moment. These men are unabashedly war profiteers, are they not?
There is no doubt they are war profiteers. They started as poor musicians from Kosovo 11 years ago and became enormous millionaires. You can't become millionaire in a state which is undergoing sanctions and economic problems without being very close to Milosevic himself.
And in the post-Milosevic era, they're trying to reinvent themselves as entrepreneurs and freedom fighters?
They try to wash their hands of everything that has to do with Milosevic and cooperation with Milosevic. They want to show off as people who have gained their wealth according to the law. That's why they founded a few years ago Karic Foundation, which is giving all sorts of money awards. Sometimes it goes to academics, sometimes to scientists, sometimes to journalists.
Now tell me about Bojana Lekic.
Bojana Lekic for sure was a symbol of B92 struggle against Milosevic's regime, and she is a good journalist, very popular. She interviewed almost all opposition politicians, but also politicians within the Milosevic's regime. She was not afraid to question them. She, for sure, is a symbol of independent journalists.
And lo and behold, one of the latest recipients of a large cash award, care of the Karic Brothers Foundation, was Bojana Lekic.
Yeah, Bojana was one of three people awarded, and she decided to go there and to receive the award. The fact that Bojana received the Karic Award for independent and professional journalism had an enormous reaction from all sides of society. A lot of journalists within B92 thought that, in a way, that was a treason. And finally, after 10 days of various public statements, TV shows, interviews, Bojana have come to a decision that she would, for the time being, leave the post of editor-in-chief and B92 television.
Now, it has often been observed that in Serbia, particularly through the Milosevic era, hardly anybody was pure. There are always connections to people who are in one way or another doing business with the regime. Isn't that the case?
Yeah, I would agree with that. The basis of Milosevic's regime is to form a criminal society in which every citizen would in a way be criminal, because in order to survive, he or she would have to break some laws. So the reaction over this Karic Award this year was so huge, because if there are people who are clean, Bojana Lekic is one of them.
The fact that Bojana Lekic, this hero of independent journalism, has decided ultimately to accept the award in the first instance and then not to return it after the controversy. What does that tell us?
Well, I can tell you what Buona explained as her reason to accept the award. She told the public, she told me personally, that the reason to go there and receive the award in public is that she wanted to show the hypocrisy of the society, because so many public figures are involved in Courage Foundation, so many public figures were present when the awards were given, and nobody has criticized them. That was her idea. I really don't understand why she did it. I would prefer if she never received that award.
What effect will it ultimately have for journalism in Serbia?
Well, the first immediate effect it could have was the possible destruction of B92 credibility and B92 itself. But I think even Buona has helped a lot that all other B92 journalists stay together in this. And I think, after all, it would only have impact on Buona's personal and career and life.
And what about that impact? Will she work as a journalist in Serbia after this?
She's a journalist star, and she will always have the audience, whatever she decides to do. Personally, I really admire Buona. She is a brave woman. She faced Milosevic's regime, and she was in a lot of trouble, and she has never been scared, and she continued fighting. I say I'm very sorry that she has decided to receive that award. I'm not judging her, and I hope that she will return as a journalist very soon to Serbian scene.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Nebojša Samardžić is a lawyer representing the Association of Electronic Media in Serbia.
Journalist and critic Barbara Ehrenreich has just written a book about how the other half lives. I mean that half, and I use the term colloquially, of those of us who are poor. A fact that goes underreported, she says, is that having a job doesn't rescue a person from poverty. 20% of the homeless have full or part-time jobs, and according to the Conference of Mayors, 67% of adults requesting food aid are people with jobs. Her book, Nickel and Dimed, About Not Getting By in America, focuses on the working poor. Barbara Ehrenreich, welcome to the show.
Glad to be with you.
In Nickel and Dimed, you went undercover, so to speak.
Yes, I wasn't really undercover. I was using my own name and so forth. But the idea was initially just simply to see if I could make enough money in entry-level jobs to live on for a month at a time. And I tried this in three different cities. I ended up working as a waitress, a hotel housekeeper, a nursing home aide, a Walmart floor clerk, and a maid with a house cleaning service.
What was the reaction to your book?
I'm amazed at the response, that there is a lot of interest in it and that a lot of people are quite surprised.
People were surprised that there were poor people out there?
I think there is an element of that, yes, in the reception to the book. Focus in the media tends to be on those more sensational things that the so-called underclass does. You know, very poor people will get into the news if they commit a crime or neglect or abandon their children or take drugs or something. But the much larger number of people who are the working poor, they don't get a lot of attention in the media.
Have you tried to write on this subject before?
Oh, again and again and again. I mean, it's really pushing uphill. A few years ago, I was pitching a story on women in poverty to an editor of a major national magazine that will go unnamed. And we were out in one of those, you know, luxurious lunches. And he was really visibly bored with my idea and sort of rolling his eyes. And finally, we get to the end of the lunch, and he said, okay, Barbara, do your thing on poverty, but make it upscale.
Upscale poverty. What is that?
I don't know. But you see, he so clearly was revealing what is a very common media bias that, You know, we want to present an upscale image because that's what attracts advertisers.
So as someone who's very sensitive to this issue, could you summarize the way you see the poor and the issues related to the poor presented in the mainstream media?
I just don't think there's very much about them. We used to have Roseanne on TV. We don't have her. I mean, there's this almost elimination of anybody who in the sitcoms and dramas anyway, who isn't a young doctor or a young lawyer or something like that.
You mentioned Roseanne. I remember when that show showed up on the networks, and there were a lot of stories talking about the big breakthrough, someone recognized as an ordinary working stiff making it to prime time.
Well, there have been different breakthroughs in the past. I mean, in the early 60s, there was the, quote, discovery of poverty, which is sort of funny, and like Columbus discovering America, you know, it was always there, but the media discovered it. In the wake of Michael Harrington's book, The Other America. Then in the late 1960s, early 70s, there was a, quote, discovery in the mainstream media of the blue-collar working class with movies like The Deer Hunter, movies that were about that group. But, you know, after in the 80s, that tapered off, and then in the 90s, there's just they're gone. They're not, you know, it's the invisible people.
After you've overcome the resistance and you've gotten some of these stories into the press, what has been the reaction?
Not much. I have to say. I mean, I've tried different ways of writing about this. I've written, you know, your statistical-filled, heavy-duty essays. I've written humorous things about this invisibility of the poor. And I felt like, what does it take?
So, Barbara Ehrenreich, what do people want you to write about?
Let me think. I find myself facing a lot, a kind of ghettoization into so-called women's issues.
But not working class women.
No, I think class is a taboo in our society. It really is. I mean, it is amazing the things I can get away with saying on a subject of, say, sex or sexuality or gender. But really, the door shuts when the issue is economic inequality.
Well, thanks very much.
Oh, thank you for having me on.
Barbara Ehrenreich is the author of Nickel and Dimed on Not Getting By in America.
As Person not looking as solid as he was in the beginning of the game, but not the best all-around pitcher in the
that
world.
That play-by-play of a New York Mets baseball game wasn't broadcast over the air by a professional sportscaster. It was narrowcasted over the internet by an amateur sportscaster fulfilling his lifelong dream of calling Major League Baseball play-by-play. The service is called Fancast.com, just launched. Joining me now is Fancast founder Adam Epstein. Adam, welcome to OTM.
Good to be here with you, Bob.
Fancast.com, how does it work?
Fancast.com is a website that lets sports fans become sportscasters for the first time ever. From the comfort of their own home, watching television, they can log onto the website with their computer right next to them. Needing only a computer microphone or a headset, they can broadcast to thousands of listeners in real time with less than a 1 second delay.
Now, was this a case where you learned about the technology and decided that this was a perfect application for it, or is this an idea you've had all along and have been just waiting for the right technology to come along?
I dreamed about the ability to let fans broadcast well before the internet even existed. And in fact, I left my job in September, and I didn't find a technology company until December.
Do you think it will really be a laboratory for future broadcasters, or just sort of a World Wide Web vanity press for the hopeless?
I actually have grander visions. I think it will replace sportscasting altogether. You know, as the technologies of television and internet converge, you could be watching the Mets game last night, and you'd have a menu of announcers you choose from, and it'll give you their styles and their perspectives and how many people like them and listen to them. And I think that's where Fancast is going.
Okay, here's a question. Any use of the pictures, descriptions, or accounts of this game without the express written consent of the fill-in-the-blank Major League Baseball club is strictly prohibited?
Yeah, I was an attorney before I launched the website. I obviously researched the law on the issue. The law is that you're allowed to speak about sporting events after they've been broadcast into your home. We're not allowed to rebroadcast the video. We're not allowed to rebroadcast the audio. We're not doing either of those things, so we're not violating any copyright law.
Adam, there are some things that people just say. And one of the things that people say is that they can't stand sports announcers because they're just so tedious and dreadful and they never stop talking. I think it might be a fair comment that you really don't appreciate even your least favorite sports broadcaster until you've heard an amateur at work. Can I play you something?
Sure.
We're going to the top of the fifth inning to lead things off for New York is Kiyoshi. I'm sorry, I wasted a gong. It wasn't Shinjo leading things off. It was Desi Rutherford.
It's the first time I've ever heard premature gongulation on a radio broadcast.
But when have you ever heard a gong to begin with? That's James Segizzi. He does Mets games, and he's actually very entertaining. And James is getting experience being a broadcaster. So for James, I think, you know, if you spoke to him, he'd tell you that this is a great opportunity. And of course he's young, but the website's young.
James Segizzi, welcome to On the Media.
It's a pleasure to be here.
How did you find out about Fancast.com?
Around April or so, I was just flipping through the internet and came across it and just decided to send a resume and a tape to Mr. Epstein, and then the rest is history.
This must have seemed like it just dropped from heaven to you.
Absolutely. I was pretty much looking to a life of living in some swamp water town for the next 5 to 10 years, trying to build up a following and honing my skills, and then hopefully eventually working my way back to New York or wherever. So definitely Fancast.com is a gift from heaven.
Now, I think you won't argue with me when I suggest that you're a little on the unpolished side as sportscasters go.
I'm rough around the edges right now. I understand that, and I do think there is room for improvement, and I'm willing to do whatever it takes to get to be the best I can be.
Let's listen to a bit of James Segizzi from a Phillies-Mets game earlier this week.
Left center field, under it is Burrell, and he pump throws, and again a bit of a vapor lock from Burrell. What the hell was he doing? As Robin Ventura scores easily on another sack fly from New York.
I've never heard Ralph Kiner say what the hell was he doing.
I just wanted to try it out, see what response I would get from it. But I do think that broadcasters should bring an enthusiasm to the game, and it should be like sitting at the ballpark with a guy next to you, just, you know, having fun and experiencing it. Of course, it loses something that you're not at the ballpark or you're not surrounded by the crowd and things like that. But again, life's a trade-off. So I'd definitely make that trade any day of the week if I could practice what I love to do at the comfort of my own home.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Garfield.
James Segizzi is an aspiring sportscaster in New York City, and Adam Epstein is the founder of Fancast.com.
Coming up, how legal payola makes hit songs, the death or near death of the single, and the long life of the record scratch.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio. Welcome back to On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Behind the constant countdown of top 40 hits, the generic playlists aired from coast to coast, is a tawdry tale of money, music, and middlemen. There are three main players. First, there are the record labels, who pay independent promoters known as indies to make sure their artists get on the air. Second, the indies, the middlemen who pay for exclusive access to radio station programmers. And third, the radio stations, who play the songs the indies promote. Recently, however, one record label decided to take a slice out of the middleman's take. Eric Bollert is a senior writer for Salon.com and an expert on pay-per-play. So, Eric, one more time. every time a new song is played, the indie gets paid by the record company.
Right. Every time a new song is played on a pop, rock, urban, country station in this country, someone's getting paid, and that person getting paid is the indie. And the person paying them is the label. So in a small market, it might be $500. In a medium-sized market, $1,000.
Per play, per song.
Per song. Major markets, up to $5,000 or $6,000.
How much money does a successful independent promoter make?
You know, you could just have a small shop, and, you know, you have a fax and an office and a secretary, and you have 10 stations that you deal with, pop stations. You could easily make $1 million a year.
For doing virtually nothing.
Yeah. There's almost no salesmanship on the indie part. It's all about toll collecting. If an indie claims a station exclusively, they don't care what the station plays because they're going to get paid regardless.
Basically, what they do is they write a check to each of the stations that they have exclusive access to, and then they send out invoices to the record companies. Why do either of these parties need this middleman? He seems to do nothing but cost money.
For a record company to pay a radio station, the radio station would have to announce it every time it played the Mariah Carey song. They would have to say, that was bought to you by Columbia Records, and no one wants to do that. So they hire the indie. The indie takes the money and turns around and gives it to a station in a lump sum of a promotional budget. But every song comes with a price tag. Every week, the labels issue their priorities, their new singles, and they will say right on the list how much each song is worth. $800, $1,000, $1,500. And everyone sort of understands what the relationship means. It means you have to add enough songs for the indie to make money. You have to add enough songs that are expensive enough for the indie to make money, and then everyone's happy.
So the indie basically intimidates the general manager or the owner by suggesting that if they don't play the songs that reap the best benefit for the indie, he may not come around next year with a nice lump sum up front. How does he intimidate the record companies?
If for some reason he doesn't get paid, it's very rare. The fear is that the next band, 2 weeks from now, that will be kept off the air because the indie never got paid.
So it's a kind of stranglehold.
It is, but, you know, the labels pay this money willingly. I mean, they could have ended it 10, 20, 30 years ago. They tried haphazardly a few times, but there's always someone who was willing to pay. You know, they can't all get together and say, we're not going to pay indies because that's sort of antitrust. You can't meet with your competitors and instead we're going to stop doing business with these people.
There was an attempt at a boycott at some point.
There was. In the early 80s, in 81, they tried, and all of a sudden their superstar acts weren't getting on the radio. And that fizzled because the artist put an end to it.
What is the impact here on somebody who likes to listen to the radio?
Well, the impact is if you're not on the major label, you can't possibly get on the radio. Because if a programmer falls in love with a song and plays it just because he loves it, he's going to hear from his indie, and the indie's going to tell him, why are you playing songs that no one is even pitching you on? Because I'm getting paid by labels to get songs on the radio. Here's this little local band you're playing, and there's no indie, and that makes me look bad. It doesn't last long. They're off the air in a couple of weeks.
So the industry has been awash with money. It's been boom times, but not so much now. And so then along comes Bootalicious.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we're doing this interview.
It's the latest example of the record companies trying to get a hold of this whole chaotic system. Columbia Records is promoting the new Destiny's Child single, Bootalicious. They've had 6 number ones in a row. They're probably the hottest pop R&B act in the country right now. And Columbia told indies that we're only going to pay for ads at stations in the top 50 markets. And it seems like a minor attempt, but it's been a long time since the labels tried to send the indies any sort of message at all.
And how have the indies reacted?
The ones I talked to who actually were outside of the top 50 markets, they actually thought it was a good idea. I mean, they're not going to get paid because their stations don't qualify. But they agree that the system needs what they call the correction.
Does the fact that one enormous record label has given some indies a slap on the wrist for what is seen as kind of uniform and systematic extortion, is this going to have any effect on what the person who likes to listen to music on the radio is likely to hear?
Well, it'll depend. I mean, if other labels follow, they have to all do it at once. Because if they don't, everything is just sort of washed away.
And if the other labels do, let's imagine a pie-in-the-sky scenario.
Yes.
And they've gradually cut off the spigot to these independent promoters who go into some line of work where they're actually doing something.
Uh-huh.
Have the record labels then shot themselves in the foot? They've lost their exclusive, paid-for access to station time, and this leaves more room, perhaps, for the little independent labels to squeeze in?
Well, there's always that theory that, you know, the labels bemoan the fact that it's so expensive, but in private, their suggestion is they don't mind that it's that expensive because it limits the playing field. And instead of five major record companies duking it out for the playlist, now you have 200 labels duking it out.
So how do the little guys get heard? The internet?
Oh, I guess. It's not commercial radio. There's no way.
Eric Bollert, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Eric Bollert is a senior writer for Salon.com.
There was a time when independent producers of modest means could spend a few hundred bucks on a single and talk a programmer into some local radio airplay. In fact, nearly half the chart-topping hits of rock and roll's golden age came from those independents, and all their hopes were pinned to those little records with the big holes, the 45 RPM single. On the Media's Rex Doan reports on where have all those singles gone.
The 45 had been introduced as early as 1948, but it was the convergence of this emerging technology with the burgeoning youth culture that set off the explosion. Gene Scolati has written about pop music for over 35 years and currently serves as the director of special issues for Billboard magazine.
The 45 is just inextricably bound up with that whole late 50s through pretty much middle 60s period of popular music. I mean, it's the standard, and it's the platter on which the meal arrives. I mean, there's almost no distinction between the content of what's on there and the format in which it's delivered.
Jim Dawson is the co-author of the book What Was the First Rock and Roll Record? And for Dawson, Johnny Ace's Pledging My Love from 1955 signaled the true coming of age for the 45.
Forever, my darling, my love will be true.
That record, which was a huge hit, actually sold more 45 records than it sold 78, and showed that the young people had embraced the 45.
Billboard's Gene Scolati notes that long before the onslaught of music videos and the seeming endless parade of pop star pictorials and slick magazines, the 45 represented the only tangible link between artist and fan.
The names of these acts and the names of the songs and the labels, all this iconography, that's all that's available. It sort of adds to the mystery of the experience, you know what I mean?
Consider, too, the ritual involved in playing a 45. Pop in a CD and you can go fold laundry. But to play a 45, you must make a special commitment. Place the record on the turntable, lower the needle, and stay and listen until the music runs out. It's an archaic process that places special emphasis on that song for that moment. A solitary throne for a favorite artist and a favorite tune.
Oh, my soul. Baby, 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 baby. Don't you know my love is true? Honey, 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 honey. Get up off of that money. Love, 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 love.
To be sure, 45 collectors seem alarmingly fetishistic about such matters. They speak of label variations, B-side oddities, and the hopelessly obscure. It is an affliction at times only understood by the afflicted.
If you've got a child who exhibits signs of complete vinyl mania, then you might have sent him to a 12-step right away, or failing that, some sort of conditioning therapy.
Dick Blackburn is a longtime 45 collector, currently working on a novel about his passion.
I got into 45s because every time you put a needle on a new one, no matter which one you're trying to listen to, there's always the potential that you're going to get a mule's kick between the eyes of originality, eccentricity, and genius.
My soul!
While 45 collectors like Blackburn spend years picking through the bones, those discarded discs from decades ago, the record industry has responded with what one might term mild indifference. In the late 1980s, when 45s were abruptly ushered out of the stores, along with a vinyl LP to make way for compact disc, major labels feebly offered singles and CD singles for customers who wanted a song instead of an album. The single quickly flopped, and the CD single has been steadily fading. In recent years, tiny low-budget labels have filled the void by pressing select oldies on 45 for jukebox owners and operators to spin. And diehard collectors can turn to labels like the Brooklyn-based Norton Records, whose passion for the format far exceeds minor concerns, like making money.
To me, that's the number one format.
Label co-founder Billy Miller.
You know, when you bottom line the profits, there is no profit in making 45s. So you have to just keep the momentum going and keep putting it out and hope you don't wake up and come to your senses.
Even the fad interest in old records spurred on by club and hip-hop DJs have largely passed the 45 by. Their interest in vinyl is strictly limited to LPs and 12-inch singles. And so, the 45 RPM record now spends its twilight years in collectors' magazines, flea markets, and garage sales. Inevitably, CDs too will be forced into an extinction of their own by some new technology. But as long as the baby boom endures, the unassuming 45 will retain a resonance that transcends the music caught in the grooves. For On the Media in New York, I'm Rex Doane.
Singles are dying, vinyl records are almost dead, recorded music as a whole is taking a hit because of MP3 and Napster, but we at On the Media have noted a counter trend. It seems that the public appetite for the sound effect does not in any way track with the public's appetite for records themselves. The scratch is everywhere, including in this report by On the Media's producer-at-large, Mike Pesca.
In a Bud Light commercial that's currently airing, a young couple walk into a jewelry store and the woman falls in love with a diamond ring. Just as the guy starts to think about how much this'll set him back, he is distracted. What's this?
They're fantastic.
Beckoning to him through the window is a beautiful woman holding a bottle of Bud Light. Do you mean me, his gestures say? The beautiful woman crooks a finger. The guy is drawn to her cold-filtered siren song. He can't believe it. This sort of stuff never happens to...
Who's the guy? Who is this guy?
For the great taste that won't fill you up and never let you down.
Oh, no. The woman wasn't beckoning to him at all. She was shooting a Bud Light commercial. Within this, the Bud Light commercial we're talking about. The guy is now forced to buy his fiancée a bigger diamond. And the cue that his world was about to lose all color, cut, and clarity? The sound effect, which says, whoa, wait a minute. NBC's promo department seems particularly in thrall of the record scratch.
Tuesday on an all-new Frasier, Daphne's back, and Niles has big news.
We're going to consummate our relationship.
What? And for Saturday Night Live?
And now something every mother wants to hear.
Just getting acupuncture on my hoo-ha.
It's the new Saturday Night Live primetime special.
The screech in the Bud Light commercial may have been in context. Perhaps they were playing a record on the set of the commercial within the commercial and suddenly yanked it off. But Frasier and Saturday Night Live, they just used the scratch as scratch. Then there's this spot for AT&T, where two teenage boys need a ride home after a Destiny's Child concert.
Hop on in, guys.
And who pulls up in an abandoned parking lot but the band itself?
File this under never. Need a ride?
Come on, kids, get real. Destiny's Child giving you a ride home in their limo, and on top of that, their hit singles being played off of vinyl? According to Record Industry Association of America statistics, vinyl records account for less than 1% of all recorded music sold. But according to Baker Smith, the director of the Destiny's Child ad, commercials use record screeches and scratches like they're going out of style. Which, of course, they are.
We always know, you know, at the end of the meeting, we haven't cracked it. Someone goes, well, we can always put a record scratch on it. Like, oh, good job, Bob. Way to go, Fred. Sort of congratulate ourselves, and it's going to be funny now, and move on. So I think that the record scratch is so much a part of our culture comedically that it's probably going to be in the Smithsonian someday.
Even after he decides to use the record scratch, Smith still has choices.
There's different ones. I feel very passionate about the record scratch.
I mean, it's very rare that I'm writing anything that couldn't benefit from a vinyl record scratch.
John Abood is co-founder of ModernHumorist.com. He, too, is no stranger to the lure of the scratch.
call me a hack, but I tend to insert that wherever possible.
One place Abood used the Scratch, actually he admitted it was the only place, was on a project for Microsoft. The software maker hired him to design a website about the little paperclip character that pops up in Microsoft Word whenever you try to write a letter. Microsoft's selling point was that their new word processing program wouldn't annoy users with this paperclip feature. They used Gilbert Gottfried to play the paperclip and the record screech to hammer the point home.
Why, hello there. As soon as I finish this proposal, I...
It looks like you're writing a letter. Would you like help?
You!
To Abood, the record scratch harkens to days gone by.
It wasn't uncommon at the turn of the century for a pair of lovers to be dancing to a phonograph in their parlor when the jilted suitor would burst into the room and, you know, rip the needle off the phonograph, and the lover's reverie would be interrupted by this, you know, brutish thug. And that was a classic symbol that carried on into many of our cartoons, many of our commercials. It's part of our collective unconscious.
Abood's jilted suitor scenario supposes the record is a 78 being played on a Victrola, hardly a reference for the average Destiny's Child fan. I asked real live teenagers, Neasia Hoskins and Charmaine Sattler, what they thought the sound effect was.
A recording that just stopped, like, ripping.
What is that sound?
I have no idea.
You don't know what that sound is?
What, a recording stopping?
Yeah.
A recording stopping.
So what would produce that rip?
Oh, pausing the tape or the recording. I don't know.
What about like a vinyl record?
I know, I saw it on TV, makes that noise.
Have you ever seen that in real life?
I don't think so.
As a media moves towards extinction, it leaves artifacts behind. We listen to a dial tone before we dial the phone, even though almost all phones are made with buttons. The record scratch was once an annoying consequence of misusing the medium, but now it's genuine music. When it comes to vinyl, it may be that the only thing that avoids the slag heap of history is the slag itself. For On the Media, I'm Mike Pascal.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price and Katja Rogers, engineered by George Edwards, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Kathleen Horan, Sean Landis, and Andy Lancet, and also David Serchuk, to whom we bid a fond farewell.
Mike Pesca is our producer at large, Arun Roth, our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from National Public Radio. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Funding for On the Media is provided by the Ford Foundation, the Florence and John Schumann Foundation, the Bidell Foundation, the John T. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This program is a production of WNYC Radio New York. This is NPR, National Public Radio.